Okay, so let's say you've been working for a local business for a while, a number of years, but that business has fallen on hard times. It's been floating along okay over the last year. There were some moments where it looked like the tide was turning, but more recently the financials are looking tough again, and you've noticed your boss, the business owner, looking visibly stressed and sometimes down in the dumps. Seems like he's been ordering less and less product as time goes along, and he's been giving you fewer and fewer duties. You know what I think you might do if you were in those circumstances? I think you might start looking around for a new job. And to those of your friends that you let know about your new job search, you might say something to them like this. You know, I can see the handwriting on the wall. My current job isn't going to last much longer. I can see the handwriting on the wall. Today, we are going to read the story where that phrase comes from. And if I tell you right now to grab a Bible, which I am telling you to grab a Bible, and if you've been here over the past couple of Sundays, you might be able to read the handwriting on the wall that we are about to enter into another sermon on the book of Daniel. Please do turn to page 887 if you're using the Calvary Bibles there, upon which you will find the fifth chapter of Daniel. And just like last Sunday, this Sunday, we also are going to tackle two chapters of Daniel. We're going to hit chapters 5 and 6. Last Sunday's two chapters revolved around King Nebuchadnezzar. This Sunday's two chapters are going to center around the book's namesake, the man Daniel. And when you get there, you can put your finger on that page and hold it for a minute, because there may be some of you folks here today who were not here over the previous couple of weeks, and I need to get you caught up just a bit. So the king I just mentioned, Nebuchadnezzar, was the king of the Babylonian Empire. And when it came to a point where God lifted his protection over Israel due to their terrible sinfulness, Nebuchadnezzar sent his army to Jerusalem. They laid siege to that city, eventually breaking through its walls. Jerusalem and the temple of the Lord were destroyed and burned by the Babylonians. Much of the wealth of that city, including the furnishings and the artifacts that had been in the temple, were taken back to the capital city of Babylon. Additionally, pretty much any Israelite who had any talent whatsoever was also taken elsewhere in the empire to be used for the purposes of the king. Daniel, roughly 16 at the time, was one of those people. Daniel and three other young men from Jerusalem named Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah were then put through 3 years of schooling in Babylonian thinking and ways. They were also given Babylonian names, Belteshazzar, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And after that training period, they were put into the service of the king. Well, rather than refuse to serve their captors, these four men, as we've been noting over the last couple of weeks, took on this strategy instead. They decided that they were going to just work really hard at everything the Babylonians asked of them. In fact, they ended up being head of their class in that three-year education period. They did quality work, both in the training period and in serving the king. Quality work, and they worked with integrity, and they showed respect to everyone. But they did have a line that they would not cross. They would do all that was asked of them unless what was asked of them would cause them to break one of God's laws. That they would not do. Well, this strategy of theirs, the way they decided to respond to life in Babylon, it worked. They earned favor in the eyes of their Babylonian masters and in the eyes of God. And all four men ended up being put into positions of power within that nation. Not only did their behavior earn them respect in Babylon, but it even caused some of the Babylonians, including King Nebuchadnezzar, to learn and come to worship the real God rather than all the false gods of that culture. And I wondered aloud with you last Sunday if we might not see a good number of Babylonians from that era in heaven when we get there. Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah, and Daniel, they were witnesses of our good God in this foreign country that they'd been forced to live in. There's the recap for you. Well, if you glanced at the first verse of Daniel chapter 5, you'll have seen that we're now dealing with a new Babylonian king. Nebuchadnezzar had been a strong king, and he ruled for 43 years, a very long time. But things got real messy after he died. As you would expect, Nebuchadnezzar's son took the throne, but only 2 years into his reign, the husband of one of Nebuchadnezzar's daughters killed that son and made himself king. That guy had the throne for 4 years before he got sick and died, and his son took the throne. But that man lasted only 9 months before he was killed by the husband of another one of Nebuchadnezzar's daughters. And you think that your family system is messed up. Well, that last husband of one of Nebuchadnezzar's daughters actually did manage to stay on the throne for 17 years. His name was Nabonidus, and he actually was the king of Babylon, as we get into chapter 5. But Pastor Eric, chapter 5, verse 1 says that a guy named Belshazzar was the king at that time, not Nabonidus. And that's right, it does say that. Nabonidus actually was the king during the events of chapter 5. Belshazzar was Nabonidus' son. So Belshazzar is actually the crown prince, not the king. For some reason, and historians haven't really pegged this down. I don't know if he had bad relationships with his wives or what, but King Nabonidus didn't like to hang around in Babylon. He often was out on the front leading the army, or he lived for a decade in another town. And so he made his son Belshazzar ruler of Babylon City. And apparently, out of respect for that arrangement, the people there called Belshazzar their king. So that is who we have there in chapter 5, verse 1. And now don't get confused. Yeah, right. Belshazzar is not the same person, not the same name that was given to Daniel when he was brought to Babylon. That was Belteshazzar. That name meant, may the god Bel protect his life. Whereas the name of our prince king in chapter 5 means Bel protect the king. You got it? I think you do. One more thing I got to tell you before we start reading. You need to know that the stories about Daniel that we're going to read today are coming quite a long time after the stories we read of him in the first four chapters of this book. Again, scholars guess that Daniel was roughly 16 years old when he was abducted and brought to Babylon. And we know the year that that happened, the year that Nebuchadnezzar destroyed Jerusalem. That was 605 BC. We also know the date of the story we're going to read in chapter 5, and that story took place in 539 BC. So that means that Daniel, as we enter into chapter 5 here, is 82 years old, and perhaps he's even in semi-retirement at this point. We don't know. We're finally ready to read now. Take a look down at the Bible in your laps, and as you follow along, I'll read for you the beginning of Daniel chapter 5. It says, King, Prince Belshazzar, gave a great banquet for 1,000 of his nobles and drank wine with them. While Belshazzar was drinking his wine, he gave orders to bring in the gold and silver goblets that Nebuchadnezzar, his father, and that word there can mean father, it can mean grandfather, it could even mean ancestor. In this case, Nebuchadnezzar was actually his grandfather. I'll start verse 2 over. While Belshazzar was drinking his wine, he gave orders to bring in the gold and silver goblets that Nebuchadnezzar, his grandfather, had taken from the temple in Jerusalem, so that the king and his nobles, his wives, and his concubines might drink from them. So they brought in the gold goblets that had been taken from the temple of God in Jerusalem. And the king and his nobles, his wives, and his concubines drank from them. As they drank the wine, they praised the gods of gold and silver, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone. And let's pause there. Okay, so verse 1 had said that Belshazzar was throwing a party here for 1,000 people. When I first read that, I thought, well, that's got to be an exaggeration, right? I've been told by the people I've been reading this week in prep for this sermon that it is entirely possible that there were 1,000 people at this banquet. We saw some pictures last Sunday of things that archaeologists have unearthed from this time in the city of Babylon. And those archaeologists say that there were halls within the city of Babylon that could have held a party for 1,000 people or more. So maybe there were 1,000 people at this banquet. Now, it's true that Belshazzar's grandfather, Nebuchadnezzar, had stolen the gold goblets and all the other goods from the temple in Jerusalem. But as was mentioned already, near the end of Nebuchadnezzar's life, he became a worshiper of the true God and had instructed everyone within the kingdom to show respect to Israel's God. And Nebuchadnezzar's grandson had been told all of that. We're going to see that in just a bit. But this Belshazzar had not followed his grandfather's counsel. So here in this drunken party described in Daniel 5, the prince/king orders the gold goblets from Israel's temple to be brought out of storage and to be used by the people to drink from. And then, adding insult to injury, verse 4 says that as they drank that wine, they praised the gods of gold, silver, bronze, iron, wood, and stone. Belshazzar knew better. He had been taught differently from this, but he ignored the teaching. He disrespected God in the use of the temple goblets, and then he led all the people in using those goblets to raise toasts to false gods. And that's the situation as we enter into verse 5 now. Verse 5 says, "Suddenly, the fingers of a human hand appeared and wrote on the plaster of the wall near the lampstand in the royal palace. The king watched the hand as it wrote. His face turned pale, and he was so frightened that his legs became weak and his knees were knocking. The king summoned the enchanters, astrologers, and diviners, and he said to these wise men of Babylon, 'Whoever reads this writing and tells me what it means will be clothed in purple and have a gold chain placed around his neck, and he will be made the third highest ruler in the kingdom.' Then all the king's wise men came in, but they could not put Humpty Dumpty back together again." That's a different version. Actually, what it says is that they could not read the writing or tell the king what it meant. So King Belshazzar became even more terrified, and his face grew more pale. His nobles were baffled. The queen, and now this is the actual queen, this is Prince Belshazzar's mother, daughter of Nebuchadnezzar. The queen, hearing the voices of the king and his nobles, came into the banquet hall. "May the king live forever," she said. "Don't be alarmed. Don't look so pale. There's a man in your kingdom who has the spirit of the holy gods in him. In the time of your grandfather, he was found to have insight and intelligence and wisdom like that of the gods. Your grandfather, King Nebuchadnezzar, appointed him chief of the magicians, enchanters, astrologers, and diviners. He did this because Daniel, whom the king called Belteshazzar, was found to have a keen mind and knowledge and understanding, and also the ability to interpret dreams, explain riddles, and solve difficult problems. Call for Daniel. He'll tell you what the writing means." So Daniel was brought before the king, and the king said to him, "Are you Daniel, one of the exiles my grandfather the king brought from Judah? I've heard that the spirit of the gods is in you, and that you have insight, intelligence, and outstanding wisdom. The wise men and enchanters were brought before me to read this writing and tell me what it means, but they couldn't explain it. Now I've heard that you're able to give interpretations and solve difficult problems. If you can read this writing and tell me what it means, you will be clothed in purple and have a gold chain placed around your neck, and you'll be made the third highest ruler in the kingdom." Then Daniel answered the king, and I read this answer of Daniel's to you a couple weeks ago to show you his character. Daniel answered the king, "You can keep your gifts for yourself and give your rewards to someone else. Nevertheless, I will read the writing for the king and tell him what it means. Your Majesty, the Most High God gave your grandfather Nebuchadnezzar sovereignty and greatness and glory and splendor. Because of the high position he gave him, all the nations and people of every language dreaded and feared him. Those the king wanted to put to death, he put to death. Those he wanted to spare, he spared. Those he wanted to promote, he promoted. And those he wanted to humble, he humbled. But when his heart became arrogant and hardened with pride, he was deposed from his royal throne and stripped of his glory. He was driven away from people and given the mind of an animal. And this is the story we looked at last Sunday. He lived with the wild donkeys and ate grass like the ox. And his body was drenched with the dew of heaven until he acknowledged that the Most High God is sovereign over all kingdoms on earth and sets over them anyone he wishes. But you, Belshazzar, his grandson, you have not humbled yourself, though you knew all this. So you see, he had been told these things. Instead, you have set yourself up against the Lord of heaven. You had the goblets from his temple brought to you, and you and your nobles, wives, and concubines drank wine from them. You praised the gods of silver and gold, bronze, iron, wood, and stone, which cannot see or hear or understand. But you did not honor the God who holds in his hand your life and all your ways. Therefore, he sent the hand that wrote the inscription. This is the inscription that was written. Mene, Mene, Tekel, Parson. I'm going to interrupt here and tell you that all three of those words there referred to units of money, but they all also had second meanings. Mene meant mina. I've got a slide on this one. Mene meant mina, again, a measurement of money, but that word also could mean numbered. Tekel meant a different measurement of money, but it also could mean weighed. And parson, which is the plural of Perez, which we'll see in a second, could mean a half mina in money terms, or it could mean divided. It could even mean Persia. Let's continue, verse 26. Daniel says, here is what these words mean. Mene, God has numbered the days of your reign and brought it to an end. Tekel, you have been weighed on the scales and you've been found wanting. Perez, your kingdom is now divided and given to the Medes and the Persians. I got to tell you about something else that very peculiar about this banquet party that Belshazzar had thrown that night. And I got this not just from a Bible commentary, but I also saw it in a non-biblical historical source. Apparently, as this party was going on, Babylon was actually under attack. An army from a growing Persian power, Persians here also aligned with a people group called the Medes, had, it appears, encamped around Babylon and had been there for some time, seeking to take the city. But the Babylonians were very much not worried. They knew that their city had been built to be impenetrable to an attack just like this one. The city walls of Babylon were incredibly strong. They were multi-layered. Some were over 300 feet tall. And there were multiple defense towers along the walls. The entrance gates all were fortified with bronze. But what about food? If Babylon came under siege, that's usually a problem, right? Food runs out after a while. What would the people do for food? It was said that the Babylonians had stored enough food inside their city to feed the population for 20 years. Okay, how about water? Well, we need water too. Easy. Babylon had been built on top of the Euphrates River. The river ran under the walls on the north side, ran through the town, and then ran out of the city under the walls on the south side. They had water too. This really was ingenious. So Belshazzar and his people were so confident in their safety that even under siege, they were partying. The king slash prince was feeling pretty good, that account in chapter 5 tells us, until this hand appears and begins writing a message to him. And it says the prince's face went pale, his knees started shaking, and yes, it's true, it was at this point that Belshazzar was starting to be able to see the handwriting on the wall. Daniel came and interpreted the message, a message of Belshazzar's impending judgment and death. Look at verse 26 again. Mene, God has numbered the days of your reign and brought it to an end. Tekel, you've been weighed on the scales and found wanting. Perez, your kingdom is divided and now given to the Medes and the Persians. Then at Belshazzar's command, Daniel was clothed in purple. A gold chain was placed around his neck, and he was proclaimed the third highest ruler in the kingdom. That very night, Belshazzar, king of the Babylonians, was slain, and Darius the Mede took over the kingdom at the age of 62. Babylon had been built impenetrable to attack, and for a while, the Persians had been stumped. But they found a weakness, and I'll read it to you from worldhistory.org. While the residents of the city were distracted by one of their great religious feast days, the Persians devised a plan whereby they diverted the course of the Euphrates River so that it fell to a manageable depth. The Medo-Persian army then waded the river and marched under the walls of Babylon unnoticed. It's claimed that the city was taken without a fight. Verse 30 again. That very night, Belshazzar, king of the Babylonians, was slain, and Darius the Mede took over the kingdom at the age of 62. And that event marked the end of the Babylonian Empire and the beginning of the Persian Empire. Okay, well, we're not done. We got another story to read here. And we'll get through this one quite a bit more quickly than we did chapter 5. So as we enter chapter 6, there's been a changing of the guard. The Babylonians have been conquered. There's a new sheriff in town. We're going to see in verse 1 here that the new Persian king, Darius, had taken over, and he had now reorganized the empire into 120 satrapies, or provinces, each one with their own governor or satrap. King Darius had kept Daniel on and appointed him to be one of the three rulers who ruled over all of those satraps. Let's read. Here we go with verse 1. It pleased Darius to appoint 120 satraps to rule throughout the kingdom, with three administrators over them, one of whom was Daniel. The satraps were made accountable to them so that the king might not suffer loss. Now Daniel so distinguished himself among the administrators and the satraps by his exceptional qualities that the king planned to set him over the whole kingdom. At this, the other two administrators and the satraps tried to find grounds for charges against Daniel in his conduct of governmental affairs, but they were unable to do so. They could find no corruption in him because he was trustworthy and neither corrupt nor negligent. Finally, these men said, "We're never going to find any basis for charges against this man, Daniel. Unless it has something to do with the law of his God. That's where we can get him. Everybody knows how Daniel operates, but you know what? Darius is new. He doesn't know." So these administrators and satraps went as a group to the king and said, "May King Darius live forever. The royal administrators, prefects, satraps, advisors, and governors have all agreed that the king should issue an edict and enforce the decree that anyone who prays to any god or human being during the next 30 days, except to you, your majesty, shall be thrown into the lion's den. Now, your majesty, issue the decree and put it in writing so that it cannot be altered in accordance with the law of the Medes and the Persians, which cannot be repealed." So, King Darius put the decree in writing. And first of all, I want to say again, what is up with this Persian thing where a king writes a law that he cannot change? We saw this back when we were doing a sermon study on Esther too, because that was a Persian king too. Xerxes was a Persian guy. How can the king not be able to change his own laws? Stupid. I guess that's the way it was. So in any case, we see Darius. Darius is doing here the same thing that Nebuchadnezzar was doing in the fiery furnace story, right? He's trying to unite his new empire through religion and through fear. you can only pray to me now. And if you pray to somebody else, you have that option, but you'll be killed. Same tactic. Now, this one wasn't Darius's idea, but he was good with it. Although we have to say that it was a lie when those administrators said that all the administrators and all the satraps had agreed with this plan. Daniel certainly wasn't among that group that agreed with this plan, right? Well, for all his life, Daniel had followed the strategy of, I'm going to do what my superiors ask me to do unless it would cause a rift between me and God. And Daniel wasn't going to change that strategy in his mid-80s. So here's verse 10. Now, when Daniel learned that the decree had been published, he went home to his upstairs room where the windows opened toward Jerusalem. Three times a day, he got down on his knees and prayed, giving thanks to his God just as he had done before. Then these men went as a group and found Daniel praying and asking God for help. So they went to the king and spoke to him about his royal decree. Did you not publish a decree that during the next 30 days, anyone who prays to any god or human being except to you, your majesty, would be thrown into the lion's den? The king answered, the decree stands in accordance with the law of the Medes and Persians, which cannot be repealed. Then they said to the king, Daniel, one of the exiles from Judah, pays no attention to you, your majesty, or to the decree you put in writing. He still prays three times a day. When the king heard this, he was greatly distressed and was determined to rescue Daniel, and he made every effort until sundown to save him. So we can see that Darius had already grown to greatly appreciate Daniel. Then the men went as a group to King Darius and said, remember, your majesty, that according to the law of the Medes and Persians, no decree or edict that the king issues can be changed. So the king gave the order, and they brought Daniel and threw him into the lion's den. The king said to Daniel, may your God, whom you serve continually, rescue you. A stone was brought and placed over the mouth of the den, and the king sealed it with his own signet ring and with the rings of his nobles so that Daniel's situation might not be changed. Then the king returned to his palace and spent the night without eating and without any entertainment, and he could not sleep. At the first light of dawn, the king got up and hurried to the lion's den. When he came near the den, he called to Daniel in an anguished voice, Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God whom you serve continually been able to rescue you from the lions? And if this was a movie, right at this point, there would be a silent pause. And just when Darius's face starts to show loss of hope, we get verse 21. Daniel answered, may the king live forever. My God has sent his angel, and he shut the mouths of the lions. They have not hurt me because I was found innocent in his sight, nor have I ever done any wrong before you, your majesty. The king was overjoyed and gave orders to lift Daniel out of the den. And when Daniel was lifted from the den, no wound was found on him because he had trusted in his God. At the king's command, the men who had falsely accused Daniel were brought in and thrown into the lion's den along with their wives and children, and before they reached the floor of the den, the lions overpowered them and crushed their bones. By the way, that was also a Persian law. When someone was convicted as a traitor, his whole family got killed with him. And the idea was that there would be no descendants to come back after that king in revenge. Once again, aren't you glad you don't live in the Old Testament days? Here's verse 25. Then King Darius wrote to all the nations and peoples of every language in all the earth, may you prosper greatly. I issue a decree that in every part of my kingdom, people must fear and reverence the God of Daniel, for he is the living God and he endures forever. His kingdom will not be destroyed. His dominion will not end. He rescues and he saves. He performs signs and wonders in the heavens and on the earth. He's rescued Daniel from the power and the lions. So Daniel prospered during the reign of Darius and the reign of Cyrus the Persian. Once again, Daniel's quality work, his respectful attitude, and his faithfulness to God's law, despite severe pressure to waver, caught the eye of an emperor and moved that emperor to consider that the God of the Israelites might actually be the one true God. You should know also that very soon after this episode takes place, the Persians allowed the Jews to return home. So perhaps Daniel's commitment to God in this story, along with the powerful way that God honored Daniel's commitment, maybe that helped influence that decision. It's good stuff. All right, well, as I've been doing over the last couple weeks, I want to close today by offering just a couple of brief application points for our lives based upon what we've been reading. I actually came up with my application points for today from some studying I was doing that was completely unrelated to this sermon or to the book of Daniel. I've been reading a book by a pastor named Preston Sprinkle, and he offered some thoughts in one section of his book that tie in well to the chapters that we just read. In this particular section of his book, Pastor Sprinkle was reflecting upon how American Christians, we've been pouring lots of energy into politics lately and fighting culture wars, right? And the statement he made that stuck out to me was this. He said, "Christians, guess what? We've lost. We've already lost the culture war in America." Maybe that's true. He followed that statement up with three thoughts on what our mindset should be now living in a post-Christian America. His first thought was this: have no fear. Have no fear. Here's Pastor Sprinkle. He said, "Have no fear. Christianity was born in the midst of a secular Roman culture 20 times more immoral than America, and it thrived. Nations and empires will come and go, but God's countercultural upside-down kingdom will never end." I sure like that thought. Have no fear. And then his second thought, he wrote that we really ought to stop fighting the culture war now that we've lost it. A lot of this I'm going to put in my words here, but I'm pretty sure it's faithful to what he was writing. I believe what he was saying in this section is, let's get out of politics, Christians. We spend so much time wringing our hands and worrying about the direction of our country when there actually is very little that we can do politically to change things. Instead of putting all this energy into politics, Pastor Sprinkle says, we should put that energy into figuring out how to be like Jesus in our community, in our families, in our neighborhoods. He said that we should be putting our energy into figuring out how to love people and how to bring the gospel to them. That's something that we can do that actually can affect change. Jesus never called us into politics anyway. People tried to get Jesus to make statements on political topics all the time, and he always found a way not to do that. He didn't call us into politics. He called us to be fishers of men, to be lovers of God and lovers of people. And then I'll read Pastor Sprinkle's third thought to you, and you'll see the tie-in to Daniel here. He wrote, third, live as exiles in Babylon. We are living as strangers in a strange land, as exiles in the midst of a secular nation. We should not be surprised when a secular nation makes decisions that reflect secular thinking. We should not think the sky is falling when non-Christians embrace a non-Christian ethic. It's Babylon, and we're not Babylonians. Very interesting stuff, I think. So yeah, he says, we've lost the culture war. We're now living in Babylon. Get used to it. And going backwards here, he said, why waste our time on all this political debate and arguing and fury and anger? Instead, let's get out there and bring the love and truth of Jesus to people in our community. And his first point again was, and this is the idea I want to end my sermon with so that we leave here with this in our heads. His first point again was, don't fear. You know, Bible commentators, they love to pick out key verses when they're analyzing books of the Bible. And I've seen more than one commentator say that the key verse in Daniel is one that we read today, chapter 5, verse 21. It says, the Most High God is sovereign over the kingdoms of men. And I think we've read enough of Daniel to know that this is one of the key points that this book makes. God is the power above all other powers. He can step in whenever he wants. He is going to accomplish his purposes. As Preston Sprinkle put it, nations and empires will come and go, But God's countercultural, upside-down kingdom will never end. Israel got wiped out by the Babylonians, but God's kingdom lived on. Those who were still faithful to him had to go live among the godless nations of Babylon and Persia, and yet the kingdom of God survived and it continued. And Christians today, we may be adjusting to the idea that we now live in a post-Christian America, but God's kingdom isn't going away. It will survive, and it'll be there at the end. So, fellow Christ follower, hold on to the God of Daniel. Have no fear, for the Most High God is sovereign over the kingdoms of men. Would you pray with me? Lord God, it's true that we have watched a steady decline in adherence to your good word in America. It's been both alarming and discouraging. And, you know, we want to claw it back to the way it was, even though it never was perfect. But at least it was better. We're sorry for how things have gone in our country, Lord. Forgive us. But this isn't the first time that you've worked within a nation that isn't heeding you. And we can stand on your word in confidence, knowing that you remain the greatest power on this planet, and your plans go forward no matter what. Your word says the rocks will cry out in worship if human beings stop. You and your people will be the last ones standing in the end, standing in a heaven where all will walk in accordance with your wishes and where all will be made right. In the here and now, help us to concentrate our energies into what is the highest priority for us, loving people with your love, helping our community to know your love and to know your gospel. Lead us in this, Lord. We thank you for Daniel and his example to us. He is an encouragement. And we pray all these things in the name of the God of Daniel. Amen.